Welcome to The Week Ahead in Russia, RFERL's Monday podcast about significant developments and upcoming events in Moscow and beyond. I'm Steve Gutterman, and my guest this week is Ian Garner, an expert on Russian war propaganda and the author of a very new book called Stalingrad Lives. It just came out last week on December 15th, and the book explores how Soviet propagandists created a myth of the Battle of Stalingrad that has captured Soviet and Russian minds for 80 years. Dr. Garner is working on his second book, which is about fascism and the future of Russia, which unfortunately seems to be kind of a very topical topic. Thank you very much for joining me today, Ian.
Good morning, and thank you for having me.
All right, it's great to have you on the program again. Now, what I'd like to discuss first is whether the propaganda about Russia's war in Ukraine or against Ukraine has changed much over what's now almost 10 months since the unprovoked invasion on February 24th. I would say that in the first weeks and even months after the invasion, there was a lot of kind of triumphalism on Russian television and in remarks by officials. Certainly a lot of very offensive, incredibly incendiary, and even sadistic talk. But I think also a lot of triumphalism, kind of here's what we're going to do to Ukraine and to Ukrainians once we subjugate them. Here's what we'll do. And some of it very sick stuff. But now, as I mentioned, almost 10 months have gone by since the February invasion. And Ukraine has not been subjugated, far from it. Ukraine and Ukrainians have endured and fought back in a way that very few people outside Ukraine really expected before the invasion. Russian forces were driven out of the north within a couple of months without reaching Kyiv, the capital, which is fairly close to the northern border. And they have had further setbacks in recent months in the east and south, in the Kharkiv region, part of the Donbass, and Kherson, where Russian forces, the regional capital, Kherson, was the only regional capital that they had seized since the invasion in February. And they, in November, retreated from the city of Kherson. And while there's a lot of talk about the possibility that Russia will launch a big new offensive in 2023, possibly as early as January, many say that in some ways Russia has already lost the war. And by the way, on the subject of kind of a new offensive by Russia, as you probably know, Putin is in Belarus today talking to Alexander Lukashenko. And there's a lot of speculation about whether Belarus may send troops in or otherwise or continue a kind of step up its facilitation of Russia's war. So we'll see what comes out of that meeting. But in terms of the propaganda, there's certainly still a lot of sick stuff, really, on Russian TV and from officials like Dmitry Medvedev. But I'm wondering whether you've seen any kind of a shift in the propaganda, whether in terms of content or tone or whom it's targeting, Ukrainians, NATO, the United States, and so forth. What do you think, Ian?
I think just that last little point you made there, the shift to targeting America and NATO, is really at the top of the propaganda right now. And we're seeing, although the stories of the most extreme stuff still tend to go viral on Western social media, because, you know, we see those videos of we're going to, you know, stamp out all the Ukrainians and start a nuclear war. Naturally, we're shocked, and therefore we click like, even if like isn't the right word. We like them, we share them, right? And that's how they go viral. I don't think they're actually very representative of the majority of the propaganda content right now, which is about a kind of a slowing down of the active war and a move to saying this is less a small military operation and more that the quote unquote special military operation is part of a much wider war where Russia is all but alone against Europe, against the West, and of course, continually against fifth columnists and ultimately Ukrainians themselves. But Ukrainians are now just almost the minor villains in this much bigger conflict. And what I suspect this means is that the state is preparing people for a much longer war. There was a little spate, I'm going to say about 2 or 3 weeks ago, of talks about potential negotiations, off ramps, if you will, ways to end the war. But it was never really, in the way that it was presented in the Russian media, about ending the war. It was really about the intractability of the West, the intractability, and of course, you know, the intractability of the Ukrainians. But the Ukrainians, in this world at least, are utterly controlled by the West and by America, who is just waging a proxy war against Russia. All in all, then, it's sort of prepares this sense that Russia has been hard done by, that somehow Russia is the victim in the conflict, and that Russia is going to have to keep fighting in some way, whether it's a conflict in Ukraine or somewhere else. And it's interesting as well, just to change tack slightly, Steve, that you mentioned this, the business of Belarus, and they are currently starting to embark on a very classic bit of Russian state propaganda of throwing up lots of different narratives about what's happening in Belarus. On one hand, we're seeing more and more stories about Belarus and military preparedness, collaboration between Russian and Belarusian troops, the brilliant command structures that are in place, you know, all that sort of stuff. On the other hand, there was a story in one of the papers today. It was on RIA Novosti, which is one of the state news agencies, if you're not familiar, that called the stories about the potential invasion from the north a whole load of nonsense. Right, so you're seeing this sort of dual narrative, and we saw that before the war, before February, of course, when the government was on the one hand saying, look at all of our troops, they're on the border of Ukraine, we'll invade if we have to, we don't want to, but at the same time, we'll never invade, why would anybody say that? I don't think that necessarily means today that it's any more likely that the invasion will happen based on the propaganda, but it's interesting that they're preparing the ground for these sort of multiple outcomes. And what strikes me, though, about all of that is that they still haven't come up with a very strong rationale for the war. I don't think this is taking off in a big way. And I wonder, therefore, and this is the last point I'll make on this, I wonder to what extent they're preparing the population for just a sort of a slow burn war, an Afghanistan and Iraq type of war. And sorry, it's a terrible comparison because Russian propagandists love to bring them up, but a war that recedes from the public consciousness, where nobody really notices when there's a few hundred people dying here, or a few hundred people dying there, behind the scenes, away from the media's attention over the course of perhaps several years. And that's really what they've been doing in Ukraine between 2014 and 2022. The difference being, of course, that it was mostly separatists, or whatever you're going to call them, in the east of Ukraine that were dying, people from Donbass, Donetsk, dying before 2022, whereas today it's mostly young Russian citizens.
Yeah, absolutely. Some great points there. I'd have to say I agree or think you're on the right track, certainly, with the idea that they may be, that the Kremlin propaganda may be preparing Russians for a long war that continues. And I think part of the reason for that is that it really doesn't seem, I mean, despite the talk about a big, sort of a big new offensive perhaps next year, you know, the prospects for Russia really gaining much more territory or even not losing territory that it has taken over, don't seem great at all. So, but on the other hand, everybody says, I think that's not an exaggeration, or maybe it's a little bit of one, but that talks about peace. Kissinger had an idea for, you know, for negotiations, a ceasefire. But there, Putin has really shown absolutely no indication that he's willing to, say, withdraw to anything that, to any kind of lines that could possibly be accepted by Kiev, by Ukraine, I think. So one thing that might happen is just a kind of a continued war. And as you mentioned, this is what happened, for years in the Donbass with the Russia-backed forces, you know, sometimes with the direct help of Russian forces, holding, I think, about one third of those two regions, Donetsk and Luhansk. Now Russia holds more territory, but the prospects of gaining much more seem to be very slim. Another thing, you know, you mentioned the kind of shift or maybe large emphasis on this being kind of a battle against the West, against NATO, United States. That really seems on point. There have been kind of direct statements by kind of chief or leading propagandist Margarita Simonyan and others, you know, talking about how essentially a war that NATO or the West or the United States is fighting against us. So that's kind of really turning things on their heads. And there was a statement by Peskov, I think, can't remember the context, but the idea was, we didn't think the West would be so cruel. It's like really trying to kind of tell the Russian people, I mean, nobody's being fooled abroad, but telling the Russian people that, you know, that Russia is the victim or, you know, the defender in this war. And actually that was one of the things Putin said early on, was that kind of, we had to invade because we had no place to go. We had no place to retreat to. Well, you could have just not gone anywhere and just nobody was threatening to attack Russia. So that's kind of the Kremlin turning things on their head. I'd like to get into the second question. And actually, I'm going to ask Ian, do you think this kind of shift or emphasis on this being part of, I think you said, part of a larger war in which Russia is kind of the defending side, you know, against the West. Do you think that's partly generated because of the setbacks on the battlefield that Russia has suffered?
I mean, I think so. In some ways, it seems to me, and of course I can't prove it because we don't know what's going on behind closed doors in the Kremlin right now, but I suspect that this is the excuse, as it were. This is in response to the failure to win really anything in the war. And it's suggesting that Russia may be losing, and yet Russia remains strong, but strong Russia is just happens to be surrounded by an even greater power, and therefore we need to go all in on the military, right? But I actually think there's something else notable here, and it came to me just as you were speaking there, and that is that this propaganda seems very static. It's very flaccid. There's no new ideas here. There's no new materials. And there doesn't even really seem to be a big attempt to push forward this narrative on any grand scale. At the moment, it seems like they're just sort of in a holding pattern, just almost waiting to see what's going to happen. Unlike, for example, the Ukrainian side, who are full of verve and constantly churning out new ideas, new materials, and seem full of life. And it seems to me, therefore, that let's say, and this is a lot of guesswork, let's say they invade again from the north in February, as is being rumored, and I'm not saying it's going to happen, but let's say they do. this is going to be an incredibly hard sell for the Russian population, because once again, they're not really preparing the public for a large-scale war, a large-scale offensive, where it may be the case that lots more Russian troops die, that there needs to be another mobilization. And certainly the groundwork is there in place to run another mobilization. So it just strikes me that they're a little short of ideas, and they're not quite sure where they're going with any of this.
I'm sorry, that's interesting. I would just draw kind of a really broad parallel with the idea that Putin has, according to some, sort of been unable to really create kind of a national idea for Russia. And in a way, the war against Ukraine turned into that. But anyway, that's a little bit beside the point. But I just wanted to move on to the second question I'd like to ask, which I think is a bit narrower. It is about propaganda. One of the main vehicles that Putin has used to shape his image and to get the propaganda out to the West and to Russians and to other parts of the world as well, the annual set piece events that he has held almost every year while he's been president, there's been the so-called big press conference, the direct line call-in show in which he fields questions. It's a very choreographed, but fields questions from Russians, and the annual address to Parliament, which is really an address to the nation as a whole, like the U.S. President's State of the Union speech, and is actually mandated by the Constitution. Now, I said annual, but they're actually no longer annual. The Kremlin announced earlier this month that Putin will not hold the press conference in 2022. And it also is unclear whether he will deliver the annual address to Parliament, which, as I said, is mandated by the Constitution. It says that the president addresses the Parliament annually. Now, the last time he delivered this speech was in April 2021. So obviously there's not much time left. And obviously there's not much time left for him to deliver it in 2022. There had been talk that he would do so on December 27th, but there was also a report from another state news agency, TASS, recently that said he might postpone it and hold it next year, which, I mean, in a way, that's not a postponement because it's supposed to be an annual speech in the calendar year. Why do you think Putin has decided not to hold the press conference this year, and possibly also decided not to address the nation? After all, it does not seem like he really has little to say. I mean, he does repeat himself a lot, but he's made lengthy public remarks several times in recent months, even amid the setbacks in Ukraine. And while he often says essentially the same things, he does not seem tired of repeating his narratives, even if those narratives themselves, to many of us, I would say, seem tired and in many cases are false, of course, such as in the case of his remarks about Ukrainian history or LGBT and gender issues. So the question is really, why do you think he's decided not to hold a press conference and possibly not to address the nation this year?
I mean, the obvious answer would be that he's afraid to face the public, right? He doesn't want to appear on TV and answer questions from the public because he might get a nasty question. But that can't be the answer because the whole thing is faked, right? The whole thing is so perfectly choreographed that he'll never get a truly nasty question. The questions in the past that happened that were pointed were never really angry at Putin. There were questions along the line of, you know, well, the mayor in my town is terribly corrupt and awful and he's screwing us all over. And Putin will say, well, I'll look into it. This is the classic line. I'll look into it. And then either the local mayor will be taken away and, you know, found guilty of embezzlement. Whether he did it or not is irrelevant, but it's all a grand performance and it will be well publicized in the local media, or more often. And there is some really interesting, somebody did a piece of research, and I apologize to whoever did that because I can't remember their name, but it was excellent work. and tracked all of the promises that the direct line that Putin had made during the direct line, and more often than not, I'll look into it, turned into nothing, right? So the whole thing's a grand sham. It's not real. So let's be more charitable to Putin. Perhaps charitable is the wrong word. Let's assume that this isn't a decision taken out of weakness. Why might that be the case? Well, perhaps Putin is trying to transform his image into the image of a wartime leader. And we've already seen that. So, for example, he's been given the tag of Supreme Commander of the Armed Forces. And he's been pictured visiting troops alongside troops. We're seeing lots more of Putin in briefing rooms with generals, with people, you know, wearing those visibly military symbols like uniforms and medals. And you might say that a wartime commander who is engaged in this grand civilizational battle with the West, albeit on Ukrainian territory right now, has no time to worry about things like housing conditions in the back of beyond in wherever, Chelyabinsk, or whatever other city you care to mention. And therefore, maybe this is just part of sort of reshaping Putin's image away from being somebody who's focused on day-to-day matters and more into somebody who is defending Russia, because that's supposedly what the war is all about, from this sort of ontological threat, this threat that's coming from the West that promises to destroy the very essence, the very idea of Russians. Now, you might say that's a stretch, and I'm not sure I even believe it myself, but I think it's important that we put these alternative readings out there so we try and understand that the most obvious conclusion that we would make is not necessarily the real reason that things are happening. Because, as you note, Putin has been very visible. He's been more visible, I would say, over the last couple of months than he was during the first month or two of the war, when he really seemed sort of locked away in his bunker, bar the big stadium concert in Luzhniki in the National Stadium in Moscow. The real difference, though, I think, and if we're going to talk about practical difference, is that Putin's never really been the leader of a cult of personality. His personality is important, of course, but Putinism isn't really about Putin being a demigod in the sense that Hitler and Stalin were portrayed as these sort of omniscient figures. It's always been about Putin being a man of the people, a very good and very strong and very perfect man of the people, of course. And what I think is missing, perhaps, and what might ultimately erode some support, is the fact that he doesn't really seem to meet ordinary people anymore, or very, very rarely. So the only example I can think of from the last couple of months is when he met those supposedly soldiers' mothers in the Kremlin. But even that was, of course, faked, and now most Russians won't care that it was faked or won't believe that it was faked. But even that was situated within this sort of grand palace in the Kremlin. It wasn't Putin going out to towns. It wasn't Putin going out to the provinces in the way that he used to. And I just wonder if that sort of sense that he's not one of us might come back to bite him in some way in terms of public opinion.
Yeah, that's very interesting analysis. I mean, on the one hand, it's possible he is indeed trying to kind of distance himself, say, look, I'm dealing with this civilizational war that the West is waging against us. So I don't really have time to talk about the sewage problems, which obviously persist, and I don't have, you know, I don't need to do that now. But I think you're saying also, but that kind of change in the image or persona is part of what might make him vulnerable. The idea that, you know, he's not, you know, the people, and I think, you know, there have been times in his rule when, you know, he's shown himself to not be protecting the people when he, for instance, was unable to really distance himself from raising the retirement age and things like that. So I think probably, I mean, if I were to guess, I'd say it's probably a mixture of, well, I want to create this image of someone who is really, really bearing down and doing the job, protecting the people, and which as you say is absurd, but also I think maybe a little bit of the idea that, well, even if the direct line, which I think, and the press conference, of course, in the press conference, it used to be, I went a couple times in the 2000s, there were plenty of Western journalists there, foreign journalists, now it would be completely different. But I think even if these things were choreographed to such an extent that there could be no real challenging questions, and I think the Kremlin could easily pull that off, it's possible that the atmosphere could still somehow end up being negative to some degree. So that's kind of my thoughts about that. I mean, one thing, just the press conference, it might sort of showcase the idea that there's really, there's no free media in Russia now, and there's virtually no foreign media. So it's kind of just such a shift in the way things are that it may just seem unrealistic to even really hold the press conference. And as Peskov, his spokesman, said, well, he's going to have plenty of occasions and plenty of opportunities to speak to the press. So he'll do it that way, in a way that's even more controlled, I guess, than would be a large press conference. All right, we are getting short on time, but I'd like to take a few questions. So if there are any questions, please go ahead. Give it a few moments.
Hi, Peter S., you can ask your question.
Yeah, I'm kind of reading this slightly differently to the conversation going at the moment. I think we have to go back to the start to see where he is going now. And the start was he thought he would take over Ukraine pretty easily, stick a leader in Kiev, and that everybody would kind of accept, and that quickly turned around to the fact that Ukrainians fought back very strongly. I think his next plan was to control Ukraine by taking all the Eastern Bloc, by taking all the coastal zones, right down, including Odessa, right down to Moldova and around, and then having Belarus at the top. So he's literally built like a fortress around Ukraine. But then what he's been doing since then is slowly demolishing all the infrastructure, trying to wreck the people's ability to work or to get peace, to advance and start rebuilding their country. And that was his plan. I think he's now struggling to the point that he's trying to hold on to what he's got, because he would ideally like to put that plan B into operation at some point, which is obviously Odessa is a big thing for him, because it eliminates Ukraine's access to the sea, and hence he controls the grain, iron ore, steel, etc. But I think what he's up to now is, I think, his talk about making a an attack on Ukraine, I think is maybe slightly deceptive, because I think he has a big problem with Belarus and a big problem with Lukashenko, who is very reluctant to get involved in this war directly. And I think Putin is actually, there were various comments about how the usual stuff from Putin about, Belarus is being threatened by Ukraine and we must protect Belarus. And I think this is what his intention is. He's now looking at the long war because he knows the long war suits him. The estimates are there's $800 billion worth of damage in Ukraine. Now, nobody is going to put money into Ukraine if they're going to build a block of flats and only to find a missile comes over and demolishes it again. No insurance company will cover that. And I think so he's now looking at the long war because that suits him. But I think what's going to happen is he's actually going to give Lukashenko a ultimatum. Either you get involved in this war with us or we will basically take over Belarus. So I think he's looking at putting quite a big military base on the Belarus-Ukraine border. I think he's looking at continuing to destroy the Ukrainian infrastructure and to economically wreck it. And then when he feels the time is right, he will try and move back in again. I mean, that's just what I feel that he's up to. But I think the next move is going to be to put Belarus under much more Russian control than it has been.
Okay, thanks for that observation. I guess Ian did say, one thing that seems to be happening is kind of Putin preparing for a long war, and you're emphasizing the idea of Belarus being a big focus in the near and I guess medium future. Ian, do you have any comment on that? It wasn't really a question, but.
So I'm not an expert on the Belarus side of things, but I would say there is an excellent analyst, Comrade Muzyka. That's Comrade with a K. And if you're interested in the Belarusian military preparation, then he does lots of writing and he has a Twitter account. So go follow Comrade. And that's the person to trust and to understand what's happening there. The other thing that I wanted to say, Peter, is just about the rebuilding effort in Ukraine. I don't think it's necessarily true that Ukraine will never be rebuilt while the war is going on, because we're seeing some quite extraordinary efforts at rebuilding in some of the damaged areas already, including some of those that were almost completely razed during the, albeit brief, Russian occupations there. So I think there is hope, right? But your argument, if you're right, and I suspect you are right about the ways in which Putin is trying to subjugate Ukraine using this brute military force, just goes to show why other countries need to make sure that Ukraine can defend itself from these sort of what the Ukrainian government would label terror attacks.
All right, thanks very much for that, Ian. Time for another question, I think, if anyone has one.
Hi, Sebastian, you can ask your question.
Hello, thank you, Dr. Gardner, for taking the time to speak. I just wondered, going back to your earlier point about it being seen as a longer war with the West and NATO. Alexander Barnov has made similar arguments in the Carnegie Endowment and most recently in the Financial Times on November 10th. And he said that Moscow would be able to present further defeats as a victory of sorts, as it still means that a insurgent Russia is standing up to the West. Have you are you familiar with that piece, or what is your view of how Russian propaganda might cope with more defeats going forward in terms of this narrative of it being a longer, more civilizational conflict?
I haven't read the piece, at least I don't recall reading it. I've read a lot in the last month. But if you want to send it to me, Sebastian, I'd actually love to have another look at that. So if you could DM that over to me, that would be fabulous. But broadly, if the way that you've presented that argument is accurate, then yeah, I thoroughly agree. And if we're to understand the propaganda around this conflict and the narrative around this conflict as something that is deeply rooted in Russia's historical myths of itself, then the idea of Russia being engaged in a civilizational conflict with the West goes back centuries. But frequently that myth is based around the idea of sacrifice. And we saw that, of course, in World War II, but I can think of many other examples. So 1812, the Battle of Borodino, where Russia beats Napoleon, supposedly, and then starts its march all the way to Paris and therefore saves Europe and the world from the Napoleonic dictatorial threat. Well, lots of military historians would argue that Russia actually lost at Borodino. They lost on the day, but they somehow managed to win the war. It was a turning point. And therefore, it's interesting the way that the government today can take these isolated, and what is still, in some senses, a relatively small-scale conflict. This is not total war along the lines of World War II. We're not seeing mass mobilizations of the entire Russian population or, indeed, the entire Russian economy, although there are whispers of it and hints of it. You can turn anything into a victory. Well, this was only a special military operation. We've gained Luhansk and Donetsk. These have become part of Russia. Ruski Mir, the Russian world, is more whole again, even if in reality we don't actually control all of the territory. 80,000 Russian boys are dead. It doesn't matter because we killed 100,000 Ukrainian Nazis, right? Even if we didn't actually gain any territory in the end. I think, as many other people will have pointed out and many of you will have seen, if they lose Crimea, it will be terribly, terribly embarrassing and hard to present that as any sort of victory. But anything less than that, they can find a way to spin it, and they will find a way to spin it, as they've been painting the last 22 years of Putin's rule as a series of continued victories on the home front in terms of economy and culture. And military victories, even when things have continually been quite disastrous when you scratch the surface.
Thanks a lot, very much. Yeah, that's really brilliant, I think. I would note, I've noticed a few times, you talk about selling things as a victory, and Putin did recently, in his sort of most recent broad public comments, he did cast the current situation as a victory, essentially saying, we control the Azov Sea. So that's like, to preserve that, Russia would need to just not lose Mariupol again, essentially, and some other cities, Melitopol. So that's already an example of, the way the Kremlin can at least try to turn these gains that they've made, if they don't lose any more territory, as a victory. And there was another comment. So I think they've been laying the groundwork for that kind of just in case. There was a comment from Margarita Simonyan again, saying, "Oh, we essentially," and this plays into the war against the West and NATO. We essentially did take Kiev. We were at the airport, Hostomel, but then kind of decided to go another way, or that sort of thing, and that it's a big war against NATO. So I think there have been signs of kind of an effort to, I think, at least keep options open by casting anything that's happened so far, as a victory. Okay, I think we have time for one more question, if there is one. Okay, I don't see any hands. So let us...
We have a question from Anna Reed asking if you could comment on Putin's visit to Belarus today.
Sure. So I think this really plays into some of the things that we've already talked about, the idea of preparing multiple potential narratives. But there's one thing that we haven't mentioned, and that is the fact that there's been this sense that Russia is very isolated against the West that we've talked about, that Russia is fighting this civilizational battle. And what Russia has continually done, especially in the last few weeks, this is really ramped up, is highlighted to the countries where Russia still has friends. And Belarus, of course, is a big one, not because it's a particularly strong or big country militarily or economically, but when we're talking on the level of sort of this ideological brotherhood, the idea of Russian world, Belarus is a key partner. And so when Putin makes one of his very now rare foreign trips, and even rarer trips to meet another head of state, because nobody really wants to meet him beyond a small crowd of people, it's great PR for him to step down off that plane, as we saw this morning, and be met on the runway by Lukashenko. He will be given the full five-star treatment. It makes for a great performance of somebody who is in a strong position, somebody who is listened to abroad, because there was some pretty humiliating stuff, you may remember, a few months ago of the Organization of Post-Soviet Nations and Putin being stood up or having to wait for some of the other leaders from Central Asian nations that have been typically been seen as, if not subjugated to Russia, then followers of Russia in all things policy and all things politics.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd have to agree that for Putin, the footage of him landing in Belarus is positive PR, certainly. Thanks very much for that, Dr. Garner. And let us wrap it up here. Ian, thanks very much for joining me. Really great insights, and I hope to talk to you again in the new year.
Thank you for having me, and thank you, everybody, for listening and for the excellent questions.
All right, great to have you, and yes, thanks very much for the questions. Once again, I've been speaking to Dr. Ian Garner, an expert on Russian war propaganda, whose brand new book, Stalingrad Lives, explores how Soviet propagandists created a myth of the Battle of Stalingrad that has captured Soviet and Russian minds for 80 years, and he's working on a new book about fascism and the future of Russia. And my name is Steve Gutterman, an editor for Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus in the Central Newsroom at RFERL. As I mentioned at the start, this conversation will also be published as a podcast, and you can subscribe to The Week Ahead in Russia and other RFERL podcasts on Apple, Spotify, Google, and other podcast platforms. Now, please note that, unfortunately, The Week Ahead in Russia will be taking a lengthy break, but I'll be back on January 16th for the next edition. Meanwhile, please keep an eye out this Friday for my newsletter, The Week in Russia. Thanks for listening, thanks for your questions, and happy holidays.